You are listening to the In Her Flow podcast with Gina and Serena. We created this podcast to help you nurture and connect to your flow, whilst also reducing the stigma and shame surrounding periods.
Each week, we will share episodes that explore conversations with female health practitioners, industry expanders, and everyday women. We are so grateful that you're tuning in to today's episode.
So welcome back to the Inner Flow podcast. We are so grateful to have you join on the show today, Caitlin, and to chat all things pelvic floor. So welcome.
Thanks for having me, ladies.
So first of all, we ask all of our guests, how did you feel about your first bleed compared to how you feel about it now?
Love this question. Definitely have not been asked this question ever in the history of my working life.
Yeah, I love that.
So I think my mum was really great in that she was excited and a little bit emotional. So I knew it was something that was pretty significant in my female life.
Yeah.
But I guess most of my friends were doing things like taking the pill to try and skip periods or control their period. Yeah. And the chat amongst most of my friends at the time was, you know, it's embarrassing and a burden on your life. Mm. And so I guess lots of those social constructs at the time affected how I felt about my first bleed.
Mm. Yeah, yes, it would. Definitely.
And then I think fast forward to today, where amazing ladies like yourself have assisted in just increasing the knowledge amongst women and also the industry that I'm in. I've been through a big journey myself, including 2 years of amenorrhea and lots of work. Yeah. And now I have a better connection with my cycle physically and emotionally. I think lots of the stuff that you guys talk about. And I can definitely see that I can celebrate my bleed and my cycle as an indicator of health and connection to my feminine energy rather than just a thing that's annoying.
Yeah, and that's so, it's so beautiful to hear, because that's what we want. We want all women to say that, every woman to say that.
Yeah, absolutely. Not all the women that are just working in this space, but that is possible for, you know, the everyday woman who might be working in the corporate world, hospitality, anywhere. So that's really great to hear. So I guess we want to know a little bit about you and what you do as a physio specializing in women's health.
Yeah, so I don't know, have either of you been seeing physios? Is physio something you usually go to, or are you guys chiros, or like into seeing chiros?
For me, both. I had a bit of an accident a few years ago, so I went through rehab for a little while and have been also seeing a chiro. So I'm a little bit across both, but not so much in the pelvic space, health space.
Yeah, I feel like I'm the same. I've more seen physios for like ankle injuries or knee injuries. So yeah, to find a physio that, you know, specializes in the pelvic floor and women's health, it's really cool. I love it.
Yeah.
Yes, I like it also. So you guys obviously see that, you know, as a physio, when you go and see a physio, we either treat pain or we treat dysfunction in the body, and we specifically look at the musculoskeletal system. So I guess first for you, it's ankle pain, and then you talked a little bit about rehab, and so that's a little bit like dysfunction, so it doesn't necessarily always have to be pain. But as a women's health specifically physiotherapist, I look at pain and dysfunction in the pelvis and other body systems or processes related to female functioning, such as pregnancy or the organs that are implicated within the pelvic cavity, so the bladder, the bowel, or the uterus. Yeah. So it's definitely a myth that I just treat pregnant women or women that have been pregnant previously.
Yeah.
I see women across the lifespan. So I could see a kid or a child with bedwetting issues, adolescents with painful periods or endometriosis. Yeah. I see women having difficulty during sex due to pain and pelvic floor dysfunction right through to the end of the lifespan. So elderly women with pelvic organ prolapse or incontinence, that is the main issue that means that they have to be reliant on care and go into a nursing home because they just can't look after themselves because they're incontinent.
Yeah, wow.
So it's like
a big spectrum.
Yeah.
Love that. And why, I mean, on the topic of pelvic floor health, why is it important for women to care about their pelvic floor, I guess, more than just, you know, not peeing when you sneeze?
Yes, I will try and not get ranty here.
Tell us everything.
It's easy done. No, but I think the importance is definitely clear of why you should take care of your pelvic floor when you think about the function that the pelvic floor has. Mm. So the pelvic floor, I don't know, is as somebody that is sort of you both dabble in the pelvic industry, I guess, this pelvic health, this feminine health, female health industry. Have you come across, like, do you come across regularly what the pelvic floor is and what it does, or is that something you've had to go seeking for?
I think it's very limited still at this point. Like, I think Kegels is something that you get taught about, and there's a little bit of that involved in yoga exercises as well. But I
yes, would say
it's not mainstream at all, and it is a little bit more, yeah, unique and, yeah, hard to find.
Yeah, I feel like the most I've come into contact in terms of, like, taking care of your pelvic floor is only really, like, oh, you won't be able to hold your bladder if your pelvic floor is weak. And then on the ladder is, you know, if you have a loose pelvic floor, then you're going to be loose during sex. Like, it's kind of just those two things that you generally hear about.
Yeah,
that's hear about, yeah. Yeah, and that's pretty consistent, I guess, with the type, with the patients that come through to me. The feeling I get is that same consistency. But I guess so if you think about the pelvic floor and what it does, that's then how you can understand why you need to take care of it. So the pelvic floor is that group of muscles that sit at the base of your pelvis. Mm. And then on top of the pelvic floor, you have your pelvic organs, so the bladder at the front, then your uterus in the middle and your bowel at the back. So the pelvic floor already, you can see, plays a role in holding these central organs nice and high up in your pelvic cavity.
Mm.
And when your pelvic floor is on or active or kegeling, as people would say, the pelvic floor plays a role in maintaining continence at that time, arousal, generating abdominal tension and pressure and core stability. So we're thinking about functional tasks or athletic tasks.
Yeah.
And then I think the thing that people often forget about is the pelvic floor has a role when it's actually often relaxed. So it plays a role in allowing you to empty your bladder, empty your bowel, insert or take out a tampon or a menstrual cup, or deliver a baby.
Yeah.
And I guess when you think about the pelvic floor having all those complex functions, a pelvic floor that's not working properly can then impact all those areas.
Mm. Yeah, see, I feel like so much of that is just... yeah, it's just not discussed.
No, and I think even if you were to have a chat to a physiotherapist, not in the field of women's health, you know, they're so close to what we do, yet they, you know, they don't even know. And when myself as a physio started to get into all of this work, it's just such a never-ending world of complex information, and you learn more, and then the more you learn, you realize the more you don't know.
Yeah,
I feel like it would be like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess that's why it's so important to chat about it. And I mean, the same thing with, like, menstruation, all these things that women don't know. I feel like it's a right that women should know how important their pelvic floor is.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, and actually what to do to strengthen it and to, you know, make it healthy and maintain the bacteria and stuff and like that as well around that area.
Yeah, I guess it's a fine line between giving people information and making them feel bad, or having this fear in them and giving them enough information so they can do something about it, right?
Yeah, definitely. Because I think that is a big concern when it's too tight or when if it's too loose, it is something that can be quite... I guess embarrassing for some people when they are experiencing that, and it can be a little bit hard to fix from what I've heard. I guess unless you see a specialist.
I even have women, like, the saying goes in my therapy room that there is no such thing as too much information, and you would, if you're a fly on the wall in one of our therapy sessions, you would for sure know that. But I have so many women that, you know, it takes them 1, 2, 3, 4, 10 sessions, and then by the 10th session they're like, oh, sorry, this is too much information. It's like I need to print it out and put it on my wall.
Yeah,
I love that you have such a close relationship with your clients.
Yes, definitely.
So this might seem like a bit of a naive question, but we are just curious to know if there is a relationship between your pelvic floor and the experience of, like, your blood flow and menstrual cramps and those kind of things. So relating a little bit back to, you know, your pelvic floor being strong or weak.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good question. And there actually isn't a large deal of research into the relationship between the pelvic floor specifically and menstrual cramps. And as a physio, I work a lot with menstrual pain. And so there's quite a bit of research around physio treatment for this population. So they call it primary dysmenorrhea.
Yeah.
So it's really just painful periods in the absence of an identifiable pathology. So something like endometriosis.
Mm.
And if we look at pain, period pain, or specifically menstrual cramps, we know that period pain specifically is brought about by three main factors. So I don't know how in depth you guys go into period pain or this, you know, the biology or the science behind it, but the release of uterine prostaglandins. So there's an increased amount of prostaglandins present in menstrual fluid. And then it's that stimulates the uterus muscle to start contracting.
Yeah.
And then that leads to hypoxia. And then what then leads to cramping or pain. Mm. And so that is what they think is the main biological driver behind menstrual pain. And then you obviously have pain sensitization mechanisms and psychosocial and cultural factors. So women's beliefs about periods obviously affect how much pain they're in.
Yeah. Which is, I feel like that's a whole like topic in its own.
Oh, massively, for sure. Because, you know, for some women, you could do just psychosocial types therapy and like cognitive behavioral therapy and just improve their pain.
Yeah, I can imagine. So do you see a lot of the time that when you just try to treat those physical symptoms that there is not much change occurring in your clients and that you have to kind of do a combination of those both psychological and physical therapy?
Definitely. And I think it's only in the last, say, 10 to 20 years that there's really been a lot of evidence base behind this psychosocial aspect to pain and this pain sensitization, this pain pathway mechanisms. And it's really trickled down into therapists like physiotherapists. And it's obviously a big part of how physios are taught now at university. But 10, 20, 30 years ago, pain science wasn't really a thing that was talked about, or psychosocial aspects of pain.
Yeah, wow. It's like you could be treating the same thing over and over again, and it might be okay for, you know, short term, but it just keeps coming back. And yeah, you've got to get
definitely if you don't target that aspect.
I started doing a course which is an EFT tapping course, and I could be totally wrong with this statistic, but I'm pretty sure it was something like 2/3 of pain can actually be like emotionally related and like trauma related, and then the 1/3 is just due to like the actual physical issue that's causing the pain, which I was mind blown about.
Yeah, really fascinating. And I find pain science super interesting, and lots of it pops up in women's health physio specifically, for sure. But you asked the question, and I don't want to not answer that part of the question you asked specifically about the tight versus loose, or the overactive versus underactive pelvic floor and its relationship to menstrual pain.
Yeah.
So it's really just hypothesizing and based on, you know, clinical experience, but we know that women with a high tone or hypertonic pelvic floor, they're more likely to have pelvic pain at all times, including during sex. But we haven't actually researched that, I'm aware of, this population during menses specifically. Mm-hmm. So I would say that hypertonicity likely plays a role in the sensitization of pain and therefore feeds back to mechanisms of this primary dysmenorrhea. So if I had to hypothesize, I would say women that have high tone pelvic floor, so that tight pelvic floor, are more likely to experience worse menstrual cramps. But that's the hypothesis.
Wow, I feel like that goes against like all the marketing with Kegels and, you know, wanting to be tight for sex and for your men. Like
it's crazy. Yes, yeah. Lots of myths.
It's like total misinformation.
Yeah,
for sure.
And when you think about things like, you know, vaginitis, which is usually treated, from my understanding, with like physically through those little, what would you call them? They're like little things that you insert in your vagina gradually.
Dilators,
that's right. Yeah, so that's super interesting if you just look at that from a physical standpoint. And then, I'm assuming that that's very psychologically based.
Oh, humongously. And I think the hard thing for women's health physio specifically is because we have this understanding, this biophysical understanding of why people get pain. And, you know, you see a lady with dyspareunia, so pain during sex, and you're trying to treat that with dilators because you know that at an impairment level, when you see her, she actually has a tight, overactive pelvic floor. But if you never work with her, and, you know, you then have to go into psychosocial treatment for her, but also her partner and her relationship to her partner and her relationship to herself, and you get into this spiral. And if you never really treated that, you would never get her pain better.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of referrals on if you know the right person to refer on to.
Very holistic.
Yes, definitely. And I think that's, it's only holistic if you, I guess, if you understand the nature of that person's pain. And I think I particularly at the start of my career got pretty caught up in at the impairment level, so the biophysical level.
As you would coming from a physiotherapy background, I think
for sure.
Something you learned more on the job and seeing what kind of issues those clients come with.
Mm.
And do you find that, I mean, I know for me, like when I'm stressed, my whole body is like quite tense. Do you find that women who are really stressed are coming in with more of that, you used a really deliciously long word before, not tight, but like over, like really, really high toned pelvic floor.
Yes. Hypertonicity. Yeah.
Hypertonicity.
Delicious. I love it. Very delicious.
I like that word. Yeah. Do you find that women with hypertonicity are coming in and they're also like quite stressed humans?
Oh, for sure. And you can pick the personality. They are, working in the corporate world and they have poor sleep and they clench their jaw all the time and they grind their teeth. They're not drinking much water. They drink heaps of coffee. You know, you can pick the person.
Yeah, I can definitely relate. I work in the corporate world. I am pretty good with my sleep, but I definitely clench my jaw quite a bit. So, yeah.
It will be interesting to give your pelvic floor a review.
Yeah. I have to have a session with you.
See if you've got hypertonicity.
Like, I think I'm fine, but I think you can always get better.
But that's what I mean. And it's like you could have these incidental findings that actually cause you no symptoms, and then it might be something in the future that then triggers you to have symptoms, or if you had a hypertonic pelvic floor. But other women, it just might be their anatomy and how they are and how they are at baseline, and it might not cause any problems ever.
So I guess on that topic with the menstrual cycle, is do your pelvic floor muscles change at all across the menstrual cycle in relation to, you know, fluctuations in your hormones, or are they not really influencing those muscles?
Yes, they are. So our pelvic floor muscles are subject to changes across the menstrual cycle due to the rise and fall in hormones, like you said, just like any of other muscles in our body.
Yeah.
And if we look, like if we say during the luteal phase, so that back end of your menstrual cycle,
yeah,
your muscles, this is usually when your muscles are going to be the weakest because of the levels of estrogen.
Yeah. Oh,
and as a result, if you're suffering with pelvic floor disorders such as urinary incontinence or pelvic organ prolapse, you're likely going to get worse towards, you know, towards your bleed, so that back end, and then when you're bleeding.
Yeah, how interesting. And,
then obviously due to estrogen being increasingly higher towards ovulation, so that back end of the follicular phase, that's when, you know, we talk to women about that's the best time to do your intense workouts at the gym if you're looking to build strength. It's also a good time to – it's also when the pelvic floor muscles are going to be at their best ability to have that high contractility force if you're doing exercises.
Wow, that's noted. So interesting.
Wow. And on that topic, can you recommend us any particular exercises to help women reduce the incidences of period pains or cramps?
Yeah, so like I said at the start, as a physiotherapist, and what people don't realise is as physios, we do treat menstrual pain as well. So we do have some tools in our tool belt that can help with that. But there are obviously lots of other therapists that can also treat primary dysmenorrhea. But given what we know about the causes of cramping in the pelvic floor, this obviously then gives us an idea of how we should do effective treatment. So the first one that we always say for women is aerobic exercise. 4 days prior to, and then in bleeding into your period. So whilst you're bleeding, which goes against what most women do, you know, you're feeling pretty crappy. You're like, oh, I'll give a miss to the gym. I'll sit on the couch. I'll eat crappy food. I'll just rest. But research has shown that even just brisk walking for half an hour in the first 3 days during of menstruation, you can have a significantly decreased pain experience compared to if you took Nurofen. So you have a better outcome for pain than taking medication.
Yeah, wow, amazing. It's like in the research. Blood flowing in that area.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's blood flow, but the theory at the moment is that the exercise, what exercise does is it's inducing or mitigating the prostaglandins that cause the contraction of the uterus in the first place. So you have this reduction in rise of prostaglandins, which then affects the contractility of your uterus.
It's so interesting. So cool. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So the first thing I always tell women is just to get active. The research shows that it has to be aerobic exercise, but they've also looked at pelvic floor muscle exercises specifically, and then yoga style flows or stretching flows. So if you were doing, say, pelvic floor muscle exercises, it wouldn't just be Kegeling all the time, but it would be, you know, taking 10 minutes and being in, say, crook lying. So lying on your back with your knees bent, and then working on squeeze, relax. So you squeeze for 3 seconds, you relax for 3 seconds, you squeeze for 3 seconds, you relax for 3 seconds.
Yeah.
Cool. And then you might do that, say, 10 times. And then you might go into child's pose on your knees with your hands outstretched, and then just concentrate on the relaxation or the relaxation or the letting go of the muscles around the pelvis. And then you might go back onto your back and do the same thing again.
I love child's pose. Any reason to do child's pose?
Literally.
Yes, for sure.
And
I can't wait to teach my son how to do child's pose. He needs to chill out in child's pose all the time.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. At what age do you think you'll be able to do that?
I don't know. I'll squish him into the position later. He's only 3 months, and we'll see how he goes.
Start conditioning him.
Yeah.
I love that. And those exercises that you mentioned, are those also useful in strengthening the pelvic floor in general, or will you be recommending different? Great.
No, for sure. Those are the same exercises we'd be do for strengthening. But when it comes down to strengthening, it's very personalized to the patient and what their goals are and what the reason they came to physio is. So if your goal is reducing pain versus building strength because you're incontinent, your strength-based exercises would look very different. And your dose response, your dosage, sorry, or the intensity of your exercise would be the same as you do for any other muscle in the body. So if you're trying to get, you know, big glutes, a bit of a booty, you'd be looking at, you know, 10 to 12 repetitions, 3 sets, those exercise principles there.
In terms of when you're bleeding or wearing a menstrual cup or a tampon, would you still recommend to do those exercises with Kegels, or would you not recommend Kegels at all?
With the menstrual cup in?
Yes.
Oh yeah. So you can definitely, in terms of the anatomy wise, where a menstrual cup or where a tampon sit, if they're in the right spot, they're designed to be sitting high up in the vaginal cavity. So towards your cervix, above the pelvic floor. So they're almost sitting on top of the pelvic floor. Mm. So if you don't have any pain, you could definitely do them with it in. I'd just be more inclined to do them with it out.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess it could get a little bit messy if you're bleeding.
True, very true.
I guess right position is key here.
Yeah.
Yes, for sure.
And yeah,
we've all had some slip ups with our menstrual cups previously. Oh, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Especially getting those out and maneuvering them in for the first time. It's like putting up a tampon in all over again for the first time.
Yeah, I got to say, even as a women's health physio who knows that anatomy inside out, it was still a difficult task for myself the first time I ever did it. And I thought, how the hell is your average Joe Blow doing this?
Yeah. So I guess it's really designed for everyone.
Yeah, no, I don't think it is, personally, to be honest.
They are quite large compared to a tampon, I have to say, like at least like 3 times.
I just hope people aren't doing damage to their pelvic floors is all I can say.
Yeah, that's actually what I wanted to ask you is, I saw you raise it on Instagram the other day, is like, can menstrual cups, and I don't even know if tampons could as well, but can they damage the pelvic floor if they're used incorrectly?
So that is really just going off, like, we're theorizing or hypothesizing, because obviously menstrual cups haven't been around for long, or they haven't been used by large amounts of women for long periods of time. And that's where we obviously get all of our evidence from. Yeah. So there's not much research or large anecdotal evidence into the impacts on the pelvic floor. Yeah. But we do know that weight gain, chronic constipation, and repeated heavy lifting can impact the pelvic floor negatively.
Oh, wow.
And that's by ways of downward pressure onto the pelvic floor and the pelvic organs. So if you think about how the menstrual cup works, it suctions right up towards the cervix, right? So if you're then not reducing the suction properly and pulling down, or you're bearing down to try and get the cup out because it's stuck or you can't get your fingers around it, then if you do that repeatedly, every time you try to take it out, and then every period, so monthly for a whole year, then the theory is over time you could do repeated damage to the soft tissue around the vaginal opening and the pelvic floor, right, and therefore doing the same damage to your pelvic floor as being overweight or heavy lifting repeatedly.
So that's just
a theory, and you know, there's no evidence out there, but definitely I think if you're doing it wrong by taking it out, then over time you're going to have this micro trauma, right?
Wow, I feel like that's just so easy to do, because getting it out was really difficult at the beginning. It's like you have to push it out, pull it, and then like kind of jiggle it. It's just not smooth.
And I think for the first few times that's fine, but I think if you get into the habit of getting it out the wrong way because you're not educated, and then you just saw this cup on Instagram and you're like, oh yeah, that looks cool, and I'm all for, you know, reducing waste and things like that, and so you just start using it, you don't understand your own anatomy, you don't understand the reasons behind how you should use it. And a lot of these menstrual cups companies are great at coming out and giving, like, I know some of the massive menstrual cup brands have online forums where women are talking about pros and cons and how they tried to get it out in this position, and they have actually, it's mediated by medical professionals. But then there's other companies that, you know, you just have this menstrual cup in a box, and it's like, it's almost like a 3-line instruction on how to get it in and out, nothing about the warnings of the damage you could do to your pelvic floor.
Oh, absolutely not. It's like pretty much just like three pictures and like very brief instructions, if any, especially for those smaller companies. I didn't have any idea that you could damage the pelvic floor using a menstrual cup. I just thought it was great because I work in environmental sustainability, and I was like, hell yeah.
Yeah, no, I saw that.
Yeah, I feel like as well, a lot of women actually don't understand the whole physiology down there.
Not at all. Crazy. And that's like, it's hard to say, like, what do you think? It's not their fault, but at the end of the day, like, it needs to be more accessible, the information. But also I feel like some women just lack that desire to know a little bit more about their body. And is that the fault of society, or is it the fault of, you know, intrinsic behaviors? I don't know.
Yeah, you're not knowing where to start. But in saying that, like, there's so much free information out there on Instagram, like through, you know, people like yourself and so many other women's healthcare practitioners out there who are providing so much useful information and like super easy information as well, you know, through videos and all of those kind of things. So, you know, at the end of the day, there's not that many excuses.
I don't know. Yeah. And you're right. But it's a double-edged sword, right? Because I think, Sabrina, you study nutrition. Is that correct?
Totally.
Yeah. So through your studies, you get taught how to judge the quality of the information you're reading, whether that be a research paper or an article you're reading online. You have the ability to consciously judge how biased that information, health information is, but lots of people don't have that skill, and so then they're just bombarded with all this free info and no real gauge on bias, and so it's really hard because you can be misled.
Yeah, I think
good point.
I think as well with, like, I know being nutritionists find it really frustrating because we have, you know, I went to uni for 3 years, we did 300 hours of like clinical prac stuff. Like, it was intense. It was so in-depth for science, yet the term nutritionist isn't, you know, regulated. So you can...
Oh, it must be so frustrating because I feel like the physio world at the moment is a minefield, but now that I think about dietetics and nutrition, it's a minefield. And you have lots of different people that can impact that information, like somebody's personal trainer. I think about what most people would ask for information about their diet. They go to their PT, right?
Totally. But you also have all these like girls on Instagram who have so many followers, and, you know, they might have done a 6-month course or a 3-month course and they call themselves nutritionist, and they have so many followers that really, really look up to them. And some of the things that they say, I'm just like, oh my God, you could be damaging someone's health so severely because you just have no idea what you're talking about.
And they're not doing it harmfully. It's working for them. So they think this N equals one, but until you've treated and seen multiple hundreds of people, you don't actually understand how to give proper health advice to a general pop, do you?
Yeah, totally. It's, Yeah, it's definitely something. I know there's like a lot of people quite high up in nutrition and, you know, in big nutrition bodies that are really trying to get it regulated, because it's just like I've seen courses pop up on Instagram being like, you know, 3-month course and you'll be a qualified nutritionist, and I'm like, no, you won't.
Yeah, there's a lot of information out there, even with just like recipes and like smoothies and things like that for detoxing out there. It's really hard as someone who hasn't studied that field to know what information is valid and what information can apply to you.
Totally. But look, at the end of the day, it's great, especially in terms of, you know, pelvic floor health and the menstrual cycle and women's health. There's becoming such a big conversation around it, which is super exciting, and more and more people are talking about it. It's not becoming such an awkward topic where you're like, ooh, like, I don't know if I should mention the word period or bleeding, and it's like, do it.
No, that's extremely true. And I think young women at the moment, so, you know, your 10 to 20 year olds are just coming into this world very much empowered from that point of view. Yeah.
Totally. I agree. I really hope I have a little girl one day and I can just celebrate the hell out of when she gets her first period.
Yes.
Hooray. Yes. Unfortunately, Loki won't give me that joy right now, but maybe I'll have a girl in the future.
Well, look, you can educate him so he can, you know, deal with future girlfriends properly.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Not think girls are crazy. That's a big one.
Exactly.
Last but not least, what do you think is the most common mistake women make in terms of treating their pelvic floor health? So in terms of, you know, common misconceptions about the importance of the pelvic floor or any of those kind of aspects.
Oh, I think you ladies brought it up before perfectly. It's that misconception that Kegeling is the only thing you need to do. So everybody needs to have a tight pelvic floor.
Yeah,
I would say that even close to half of the women I see in clinic at the moment, their issue is a tight pelvic floor. That's a concern. Yeah. Because continuing that myth that continuing with strength-based exercises or only concentrating on strength and tightness of the pelvic floor is definitely the biggest myth. The pelvic floor also needs to, like we talked about earlier, relax and open in a coordinated manner for it to be properly functioning. And that's not just for not for pain and continence, but also the myth that you need a tight pelvic floor to have a better sex life. You know, you need a coordinated pelvic floor that can squeeze and relax, and you need a good relationship with yourself and a good relationship with your partner and all these intricate factors more than just the tight pelvic floor.
Yeah, so important. Like I remember before I had sex, I was just terrified to actually lose my virginity because it was just so tight. I just couldn't imagine something that big going in there. So like knowing exercises to help that relax and loosen up have been so useful.
I know, super useful.
Can we go back?
Damn Instagram, why weren't you around when we were younger?
I know, seriously.
But look, I don't think I would have gotten anything done if Instagram was around when I was a teenager.
Yeah, like school life would have just been so distracting by so many things.
So many distractions.
Yeah. No homework would have been done ever.
Yeah, good luck for teachers in this day and age trying to get kids off their iPhones.
Get their
attention. Oh, I don't even know how I'm going to do, like, I'm just, my husband and I are just discussing about raising Loki and how, like, his world is completely different to our world. And kids have access to screens all the time. They do school through screens. Like, it's hard.
That's insane. Yeah, like, especially through COVID, like, a few of our friends who are teachers have been teaching through Zoom, and I just have no idea how they're getting anyone's attention, how they're getting anyone to even listen to what they say. I couldn't imagine anything harder. Also, do you have any top tips to look after your pelvic health?
I think the biggest tip I give all women is just to have some awareness of where your pelvic floor is, so know how to squeeze and relax it, and know what it feels like if it's not, or what the symptoms are if it's not working properly, so you can seek help is the biggest thing. So, you know, if I had to give a top tip or a top I guess, a top cue for how to squeeze and relax your pelvic floor, it would be using a back passage cue. So because your pelvic floor slings from front to back, often women just think pelvic floor kegling means squeezing at the front. Mm-hmm. So squeezing like you're trying to stop urine or squeezing like you're trying to tighten your vagina. But actually most of the muscle fibers of the pelvic floor sit at the rear, so posteriorly. So the cue that we know in research, if we stick little EMG, if we put machines in to the pelvic floor and sense how much muscle activity is going on when we give different cues, we know that if we give a rectal cue, so squeeze like you're trying to hold in wind, or squeeze mm-hmm. like you're trying to stop a poo coming out, then most women do the right thing.
Right.
Whereas if we give complex other cues, women do the wrong thing.
That's so interesting. I would have, because I heard that tip of having to, pee and then stop yourself from urinating. That was always the one that I heard. So that's
And it's still a good tip, but we know that verbally, if we give the cue, most women will do the right thing if we give them a rectal cue, whereas there's still a lot of ambiguity when it comes to that front cue, and some women still do the wrong thing.
Right. Yeah. Get you.
I think
because if you squeeze and relax around the back passage, you should be able to feel the muscle tighten and lift, but then also drop and expand. And it's that lift and drop that's important, not just the tightening.
Yeah. Well, I think though I went through a phase where if I tried to sort of squeeze my pelvic floor, I would either tighten my abs, or I would like weirdly push as if I was like almost about to push out a poo, but I couldn't. I know it's like my brain hadn't yet connected to that area, and I was always like, what are women talking about? Like, I can't figure out where this is.
It's hard.
Yeah, and that's why we really encourage women, particularly if you have a concern, to go and see a women's health physiotherapist, because mm-hmm. we then would tell you if you're doing the right thing through an internal exam. So we give you the cue and we tell you, yes, your pelvic floor is working, yes or no, it's not. And then we keep going through different cues until you get that motor control and that planning.
Wow. That's so cool.
Because if you keep doing the wrong thing, you're not going to get better. And then you blame the industry. It's not the pelvic floor exercises.
Yeah.
You're just doing it wrong.
Of course.
Yes, exactly.
I feel like so many myths have been debunked, which is amazing.
Mm. Yeah.
Glad I could help debunk those myths, ladies.
Yeah, even I feel like I've learned a lot.
Yeah, me too.
We'll have to further this chat one day, because I work really closely with nutritionists because you can imagine if you have a crappy diet, or if you've got IBS, or if you're constipated, how that affects the pelvic floor. And obviously I'm not the qualified one in terms of changing somebody's diet significantly to assist with that. So it'd be interesting to have a conversation around the intricacies between diet and lifestyle and pelvic floor health.
Yeah, would be, I'd love to continue that chat. And on that note, where can our listeners find out more about you and access all the gorgeous work you're doing?
So I have a 3-month-old baby, so I'm a little bit quiet at the moment. But no, they can, the platform that I'm most active on at the moment is Instagram, just because it's the easiest and most accessible for me at the moment. That's the Pelvic Floor Project. And I do have a website where lots of my information is posted. I do regular blog posts, and I do have a pelvic floor program, which is the pelvic floor project.com. But my future plan, I guess, over the next few months is to try and get lots more free information out. Cause like you said, my goal is to try and empower and educate women as much as possible with evidence-based information that they can hopefully trust and then utilize and debunk some myths. And it's not going to happen unless it's free and accessible to women. So that's my goal.
Yeah. Wow, I love that. Yeah, we need more of you in our lives, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good.
And more of Loki.
Yeah. Absolutely.
We need to see more of you.
This kid's smile can fix any bad day or no sleep. I could go 10 days without sleep and he still makes me smile.
Oh, wow. And are you loving being a mama?
Loving it. It's is by far the hardest thing I've ever done. Like, I thought I'd been challenged. I challenged myself physically and mentally, and I was juggling 3 jobs and running a business before I had him. And literally nothing is harder than looking after a small human.
Wow. Yeah. It's so much pressure as well, because it's just like, means everything to you. and you just want
to be. Yeah, and I think it just challenges, I'm a bit of a type A personality, so it just challenges my ability to control my environment.
Oh, yeah. wait till he starts throwing his food everywhere and wiping his poo on the walls. You'll be oh. Good luck with those.
Can't wait. My husband's very good at him. My husband is the opposite of me and very chillaxed and has a laugh about everything. So I'm sure we'll both enjoy that period of time.
Oh, well, that's the perfect combo. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and you've given us so much incredible information.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was just incredible. And I'm sure all of our listeners have, you know, a few things to take away from this.
Thanks very much. Nice to talk to you, ladies.
Thank you for joining us in this week's episode on the In Her Flow podcast. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review if you loved this podcast episode.
Even better, share it with a friend or family member who could benefit from this information. Our mission is to normalize period talk and help women to tune in with their cyclical bodies.
See you next week.